expert proof in the case in chief by the defendant. We've suggested this change because, unfortunately, there is some game playing that goes on, and a defense attorney may define that kind of proof as something that he is not necessarily putting on in his case in chief. And you will get someone who will give you notice, and all of a sudden this expert comes walking in, and it creates problems. That's why we're suggesting that. I don't know if that would be controversial from the defense point of view or not, but it's a minor change again. But it requires a defense attorney, if he's going to have a psychiatrist testify, to simply give notice. We will be calling an expert witness.
I have another issue that shouldn't be controversial at all, but is actually one of the most important things I want to get out of the changes, and that is to make sure, if you change it to a guilty plea or if you leave the not responsible plea now, I want to make sure that you deal with the problem that we can't extradite people that leave the state. And I do have a recommendation in Section 20 to amend the escape statute. And I have talked to Jim Russell, who works on the extraditions with the governor's office, and I think the best way might be to be able to charge a new crime of escape of those people that are on conditional release by the board. And I don't think there'll be any controversy. I'm not sure whether that's the best way to do it or not by amending the escape statute, but I want to make sure that it's dealt with. Then there's a minor, on the victim notification, there's just a minor
administrative. Yeah. Well, you're talking,
it's an issue that I don't think has been
you and I discussed
raised
the other day, but do you have an amendment now already on that?
It's in my testimony, an amendment in Section 20 to the escape statute. So I think it's essential that it's dealt with. And I don't have a preference which way, as long as there is extradition.
Okay.
I believe if we have a guilty plea, that'll take care of it. And then I have another minor recommendation, there was also a change made on the victim notification that they would also receive notification for every leave of absence. That, I think, is a change to, again, try to tighten up all of the procedures. I guess I question whether you need victim notification for every, what they call, what's in the law as a leave of absence, what the hospital would call a pass, because often the pass will be just to go to dinner with a relative, or not even to leave the city, and the victim might be in Coos Bay or in Douglas County. I don't know whether that just goes overboard on it, but it's a technical question I would have. Also, because some of those passes are approved by the phone at the last minute, where a relative shows up and wants to take the patient out to dinner or shopping.
Any others you would want to mention this for purposes of this listing? My intention will be to use the interim committee bill as the vehicle for whatever is reported from the committee. And we will, in the course of any final decisions, examine that bill section by section, as well as pulling in any other, looking at the other provisions of the other bills. But I wanted to get this sort of basic working paper in place so that we can.
I wonder if
a kind of framework against which to relate our decisions.
Excuse me. I wonder if the proposed amendments to 2075 have been. Are you considering adopting those at any time soon, like now? And that would take care of some of the corrections issues and conditional release issues. And would
all I want to do is just define issues right now. If we should, then we'll take at our next work session. We'll take up action on the specific questions that are before the subcommittee. Shape the bill accordingly. Anything else you'd like to mention for purposes of this listing? We'll prepare this in type form before we take up the bills again and circulate it to you, so if you have any questions about it or if there are any omissions that you sense after you've looked at it, appreciate it if you could just give us a call. Okay. Anything else? Any questions from the subcommittee?
Do you have any idea when they might be?
No, I don't at this point. I know this need to move on in terms of the board's budget, especially in ways and means. I'll just leave it to people. We're going to get back to it as quickly as we can. Okay, our final item before we adjourn will be to return to 2369. We have amendments which have been distributed, which are prepared by legislative council to state different alternative approaches to the question of the drug trial matter. Linda, would you like to briefly review these for us?
Mr. Chair and committee members, at the last meeting, we were working off the -3 set of amendments prepared by legislative council. At that point, we had made the change from indicted to charged, and that change is incorporated in each of these versions of the amendments. Another thing we were going to be looking at for this next meeting was to spend more time to consider the ABA standards. The way that these amendments now are framed. Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I just got these. I have not reread them. I mean, I got them while this meeting was going on, so.
Well, let me pick up. I think I can amplify your comments. All three versions maintain the distinction make a distinction between joint charges for felonies committed as part of the same act or transaction and joint charges of the same crime or crimes. In the first instance, the present provisions are in effect retained by which separate trials will occur upon the motion of any defendant. In the case of joint charges of the same crime or crimes, whether felony or misdemeanor, all three versions provide that they shall be tried jointly unless the court before trial orders separate trials. The distinction in the three versions is that in -7, It incorporates an extrapolation from the ABA standards. It incorporates the substantial prejudice standard, which was before us in the earlier amendments. Dash 8 incorporates an extrapolation of the ABA standards, which provide a pursuant, the separate trials would be ordered pursuant to a finding that a joint trial would be likely to interfere with fair determination of the guilt or innocence of any defendant. And the dash 9 version has no standard stated. It simply says the court, they shall be tried jointly unless the court before trial orders separate trials. And then the remainder of all three versions incorporates language from the California statute, which makes clear the range of the court's flexibility as a structural matter in terms of ordering separate trial as to one or more defendants and a joint as to the others, or may order any number of defendants to be tried at one trial and any number of the others at different trials, or a separate trial for each defendant. And that is where we are at this point. Mr. Barton, do you have any comment on the amendments?
I may briefly, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
The record, Robert Barton, Assistant Attorney General, Department of Justice. I've had a chance this afternoon to review the amendments and proposed amendments. I'd indicate that I think, in order of preference, our position would be that dash 7 is the most preferable. That basically tracks with the language that was in the prior amendment relating to a likelihood of substantial prejudice. I say this because, as I mentioned before, in the situation, the context we're dealing with joint trials as being the preferential situation, that is the same crime or crimes, I think there should be some sort of strong showing required of the defendant to unravel that presumption. And I would juxtapose 7 and 9 where there is no standard, just because I think in comparison where there is no standard, I think the court would all too often be inclined to give the defendant the benefit of any conceivable prejudice, even if there isn't any real likelihood or strong likelihood of prejudice involved. I think any standard is preferable to no standard, and I think that's what the chairman was seeking when we were looking at the ABA standards. I would indicate I think the ABA standard is certainly preferable to no standard, and I think if that is the perhaps the middle ground that the committee would wish to take, I think it's a fair standard to set out because it basically requires that there be a showing that it's likely to interfere with a fair determination of the guilt or innocence. And I think all too often the courts get a little bit confused as to what's prejudicial to a defendant. There's an old joke among prosecutors that everything in the state's case is prejudicial to the defendant, and in essence that is true. And that's any evidence against the defendant would be prejudicial. And I think all too often the courts get a little bit mystified by that term prejudice. And the ABA standard at least kind of puts it in the context of what is going to affect a fair determination, not necessarily what is strong evidence against the defendant. So I would indicate that I think dash 8 is certainly acceptable from our standpoint and preferable to the no standard in dash 9, because I think the no standard will end up being the status quo. That is, I think the courts will basically give the defendants the benefit of the doubt even where there is no likelihood of prejudice, but there's a mere possibility. I'd indicate as an alternative to even dash 7, if the committee found that that substantial prejudice language was a little too burdensome on the defendant, I think the thrust of what we've been seeking throughout here has been some sort of requirement that we maintain as preference for joint trials when we've got the same crime or crime situation. And I think a possible way of toning down the showing of prejudice but yet requiring a strong showing would be to take that word substantial, the adjective, and put it in front of the word likelihood, so that the finding be of a substantial or even a strong likelihood of prejudice. That doesn't qualify or quantify the degree of prejudice so much as it requires some kind of a strong showing. And that at least would require the defendant to come forth with something other than just sheer speculation that this may be prejudicial to our case or it conceivably could prejudice our case. It requires a stronger showing than just a mere assertion of prejudice. That's, I think, an alternative to dash 7, although I think dash 7 as set forth would certainly be more than satisfactory. So in sum, our position would be, I think, that dash 7 would be our first preference, and perhaps the juxtaposition of that word substantial would be the second, and then dash 8 would be an acceptable position. And I would say the dash 9, while certainly would be palatable, and we would be happy to see any change in the current law, I think dash 9 would be least effective in trying to get across the point that the court should require joint trials in all situations except where there is definite prejudice to the defendant's case.
Linda?
Can I just ask, this speaks to separation of trials, separation of defendants before trial.
Mm-hmm.
What happens in the middle of a case where there's a showing of prejudice along the way, or it becomes evident, or something comes up where there's going to be prejudice that arises as you proceed through the trial? How is that handled, or how do you?
How is it handled through these proposed amendments?
I don't know that it's handled through the amendments. I'm asking how it would be handled.
It can be handled
through the amendments, or if it's handled in the amendments, and if not, how it would be handled.
Well, the way I can relate is from my experience in California. If something occurs, generally most of this is clarified prior to trial. If there are any confessions, any pretrial motions, and also where there are joint trials, defense counsel are very keen to the idea of trying to get the severance handled before trial, because that obviously changes the whole tactical situation for them as well. But in those rare instances where something arises in trial that may prejudice another defendant, the court has that inherent authority always, whether it's a single trial or with joint defendant trials, to grant a mistrial. And it can grant a mistrial as to one or more of the defendants. If it's on the motion of the defense counsel, there are no double jeopardy problems, so the court can order the separate trial, and then that trial will take place another time and place. So I think, in a way, there's no need to put anything expressly into the bill that would cover that scenario. I think that second clause, but in other cases, defendants jointly charged, maybe tried separately or jointly in the discretion of the court, even allows for discretion of the court in the context of the trial itself. So I don't foresee this as a problem. I think, obviously, once a bill like this is enacted where the rule has been otherwise, there are going to be some trial and error situations. But the typical way it's handled is just that, just as in a regular mistrial. If something arises where there's one defendant that was unforeseen by the court and counsel, the court can grant a mistrial either on its own motion or on the defense counsel's motion. So I think that would be the remedy in those situations. And I think, too, that the appellate court, in looking back at the record, if, for instance, a court in mid-trial refused to grant a severance, if there was some motion made in the middle of trial, might look to see if at the inception of the case, did the court have some kind of forewarning that this was going to come about, for instance, a confession situation. Was there some indication that this was possibly going to prejudice the defendant, and the court just ignored it and then went through? And I think that would potentially be a reversible error if the court did deny a motion to sever, and it was deemed by the appellate court to be a situation where it had foreknowledge of the situation and abused its discretion. So I think in practical terms, it is handled in the majority of jurisdictions that I'm aware of and would be handled under this. Further questions?
Yes.
Mark?
Yes, Bob, I guess, and I know you've gone over this a number of times now, but and the language shall be tried jointly. You know, shall has always been the magic word, and it seems that I guess I'm having some trouble, because it seems that all of these statutes seem to definitely say that it shall be, and I guess I'm having trouble, and you've had the experience, though, getting to the point where the courts are reluctant, even though the language is shall, you say that they're reluctant to have the joint trial. And I guess I don't understand why with the word shall there.
Well, I think the shall indicates that that's the presumption.
Yes.
The rule will be the joint trial.
Yes.
I think what I was referring to specifically was dash 9, where there's no standard really for why the court would not give a separate trial. And right after that language in dash 9, it shall be tried jointly unless the court before trial orders separate trial. So in one sense we're saying shall, and in another sense we're saying but unless the court orders, and then there's no standard following that. And that's why I think there's a vacuum there. And I think we have to remember, too, the case law, as it is currently now, gives this preference to separate trials, and the Oregon courts are going to be reluctant to deviate a whole lot unless it's very clear in the legislation what the parameters of their authority to deviate from the prior law was.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Lombard.
I don't know. I guess maybe I'm a little dense or something, but what's the difference between the first sentence and the second sentence, the new language?
The when two or more, and then the, let's see.
Yeah.
The full sentence or the clause? Because there's...
Well, the whole clause. I mean, somehow I read the first one saying that if the defendant requires it, when there are two or more of them, that's what's going to happen. Then it seems to me we contradict ourselves in the second sentence, saying, however, defendants jointly charged with the same crime or crimes, whether felony or misdemeanor, shall be tried jointly unless the court makes that finding.
I don't understand that. The distinction is, in the first clause, we're talking about felonies committed as part of the same act or transaction. I guess the best way is to give an example. If we had two defendants that committed a robbery, and one of them, in the course of robbery, let's say, committed a rape of one of the victims, and the other one didn't. As I read this bill, they could both be charged with robbery together and tried together, because that's the same crime or crimes. That goes back to that second sentence there. But if one were charged with the robbery and the other were charged with the rape, they arose out of the same act or transaction. They both went in and did this crime together, but they're not the same crimes. And so in that case, the rapist and the robber could require separate trials and would get them under this bill, which is the current law. So basically what this bill does is it takes only identical crimes and mandates or presumes that they should be tried jointly. But if they're separate crimes, even if they arose in the same criminal episode, they could be tried separately and would be.
I guess it's my understanding that these were just prepared, and I know we've got some earlier language that has been suggested as a result of testimony from the defense side, or Mr. Hennings. Linda, do you know if Mr. Hennings or someone representing that side of the argument has had a chance to review these, or if they've got a position or are prepared to respond?
Mr. Chair and committee members, during the meeting, I gave copies to Marcy Hertzmark. They haven't obviously been seen by Mr. Hennings yet, because we just got them today, and I don't know whether there's a comment on behalf of the Metropolitan Public Defenders or not.
If they can respond, I'd like to hear it. But
Marcy, can you give us any comment at this point?
For the record, I'm Marcy Hertzmark with the Metropolitan Public Defenders. Mr. Hennings is out of town for a week. Didn't even leave a phone number. He doesn't want to be reached for a week. He's on vacation. So I was not able to run these by him. We had, however, talked about the standard, about the ABA standard. We are still have some problems with that. It is preferable to -7, to the substantial prejudice, which we have spoken on the record before as being against. And moving the substantial in front of likelihood, I don't think is going to help us like that version any better. I think we would still be opposed to that type of burden being put on the prejudice aspect of it. What we're most concerned with in any formulation of this is making sure that the individual rights of the defendant to a fair trial are assured, the rights such as cross-examination, confrontation, effective assistance of counsel. If none of those can be guaranteed by a joint trial, then there's prejudice. And I'm not quite sure whether, if we only put those three in, to work those into language somehow, then we would be eliminating any other types of rights, or whether there's some way we can generally put those in otherwise. I'm not too sure that likely to interfere with fair determination of guilt or innocence is going to include those aspects of individual rights in the determination whether it should go separate or joint. I'm also not too sure that 9, which has no standards, would be acceptable to us, because that's a fairly broad discretion and doesn't really help the judicial branch at all in making that decision. I would feel uncomfortable not giving them any standards.
Marcy, I think that it seems to me that if the committee ultimately reports a joint trial bill, that rather than attempt to enumerate statutorily all of the different aspects of a joint trial which could create a basis for a separate trial under whatever standards adopted, it might be better to attempt by our legislative history to, at least by example, provide a statement of what kinds of situations in the contemplation of the committee would be pertinent for the court to be responding to if they're raised by defense attorneys.
I would feel better about that also. I don't think we need to enumerate these in the statutes. It's not a good way to make law.
And it might be that if you could provide us with some listing of the kinds of aspects of a joint trial which you would expect to be raised as a basis for a claim
for
of interference with fair determination or prejudice, should that be the standard adopted, I would be more than happy to include that in our final discussions of it as a committee, and if the bill is reported on the floor.
Okay, I would be glad to.
The history generated by the process is quite clear on what our intentions are.
All right, I'll be glad to do that for you, Mr. Chair.
I have one other question. This is more like, well, as I'm rereading the bills, I'm trying to, before we get to the standards question again, I'm trying to determine whether the total language of the bill in the first line 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 is yet exactly correct. We first talk about felony charges, joint felony charges, when the felonies are committed as part of the same act or transaction. Then we say, but in other cases, defendants jointly charged may be tried separately or jointly in the discretion of the court. And then we talk about joint charges of the same crime or crimes. I'm not sure that those three are quite, you know, if there's some problem in the way that's now set forth.
I noticed that, Mr. Chairman, myself, in trying to go through this and analyze it, because we have kind of plugged in language from various sources. At first, I was toying with the idea of stopping at the point of on line 8 there, after the word separately. In other words, we've talked about when two or more are jointly in charge of the same act or transaction, deleting the language, but in other cases, all the way until on middle of line 10, we've got however. And what that would leave us with is the way a proposed bill would read is that two or more defendants jointly charged for felonies committed the same act or transaction, if they require it, would be charged separately. However, defendants jointly charged for the same crime or crimes, whether felony or misdemeanor, shall be jointly tried unless the court orders separate trials. That might tie it in closer. In other words, if it's a felony, same act or transaction, and the defendant requires a separate trial. However, in all other cases, whether they be felony or misdemeanor cases, where they're the same crime or crimes, they would be jointly tried. The question that arose in my mind, though, was that, but in other cases, kind of allows the misdemeanors to come into the picture, too. And it may be that if we leave the way it is, I think it might encompass those non-felony misdemeanor cases where it's the same act or transaction, and there the court's got free play, jurisdiction, can order it or not order it in those cases. In other words, we've got kind of a three-pronged attack. If it's a felony, the same act or transaction, the defendant gets the benefit of the doubt. If he wants a separate trial, he gets it. If it's a misdemeanor, that would be the other cases, and he, if jointly charged, in the discretion of the court, could be tried separately or jointly. The third situation, whether it's a felony or misdemeanor, if it's the same crime or crimes, the presumption is he's going to be tried jointly unless there's the showing, whatever that's going to be. And maybe that could be cleaned up a little bit. I don't know. But I'm not sure you want to delete that second clause. I thought of that at first, and I'm not so sure that would be the best idea. Admittedly, it's maybe not the most pristine language, but I'm not so sure it's that vague. The analysis that I've given is, I think, is a fair one. The other cases would apply to the misdemeanor situation primarily. In fact, I think entirely.
Yeah, I think it's clear enough. It's just that it strikes me as a bit
cumbersome,
awkward, and that's because we are inserting language from other sources and modifying our present statute without.
We could just insert the word misdemeanor between other and cases on line 8, and that would clarify it. The felonies are covered by the first